Stories have to be told or they die. And when they die, so does that which defines their significance. Etched in Stone is a collection of stories about unparalleled athletic achievements, discipline, and commitment of the distinguished members inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. Wrestling is arguably the toughest sport in the world. When you finish this series, it will no longer be debatable.
This is the fourth and final episode of Legend on the Rocks. I am Pat Christensen. I wrestled with Lee at Wisconsin for 3 years. In 1976, I was fortunate to be one of three UW wrestlers who won NCAA titles. I hope you are enjoying Legend on the Rocks as much as I did writing and producing it. Fans, coaches, and wrestlers seldom get an inside look at the lives of someone as accomplished as Lee. Yet his story is about so much more than wrestling. Had it not been for the unforgivable politics of 1980, this episode could have been so different. Lee's commitment and discipline allowed him to control his life up to 1980. After that, life's road would be filled with potholes, detours, and dead ends. He had one of the most successful wrestling careers in wrestling history. He earned an MBA from Wisconsin, and his dealership was well on its way to success. Once he made the decision to leave wrestling, he assumed settling down, finding a wife, and having kids would be a new and enjoyable transition from the 24/7 commitment he made to get and stay on top. But the person he chose to spend the rest of his life with would double down on the pain and disappointment he experienced in 1980.
I knew I was getting older. I wanted to have a family. It was like a goal. It was like a goal. You have to get married now. And I would analyze why I broke up with people over the years, and sometimes they were for dumb reasons. You'd find any excuse to break up with someone because you just weren't ready, maybe. I'm living in Forest Lake. And I have all this huge investment in this dealership. So it was like, I'm going to get married too.
Lee met Linda at church. However, he did not give this the careful consideration that defined his success throughout his career. He had committed his life to a sport in which he dominated, but it came at a price. It was time to experience the other side of life. He wanted a wife and a family. That is part of the great American dream. However, half of those dreams get crushed. He couldn't be any less prepared for what was in front of him. He had spent 15 years being Superman. Linda would be his kryptonite.
We know that she was deeply affected by mental illness. Not a little bit, a lot. And that was evident to our family when they stayed with us in 96 because of the level at which that she would act out, which was very, very demonstrative. And Lee was always trying to, as I observed it, he was always trying to mitigate the damage to his kids of her acting out, right? He'd sort of protect the kids and get as calm as he could and try not to respond to her.
I met her at church. She must be meant for me, but it wasn't. It was not good. It was a horrible thing. But I was so focused on getting married. Well, I'm 32 maybe or something. And I thought, man, I better get married. You know, I found reasons to break up with someone all these years. I'm just not going to break up with her. I mean, because you have to learn to get along with someone anyway. Nothing's perfect.
Lee had no experience at love or even serious dating, for that matter. In his haste, he ignored the most important rule in marriage. Take the time to make sure that they are the right one. He took over the dealership in January of 91, and he and Linda were married in November. There was no honeymoon or honeymoon period.
I was working. It was a very intense environment, trying to turn the dealership around. She was a single mom.
The tension began immediately and quickly evolved into something much worse. Lee would learn later that she was bipolar, with paranoia and schizophrenia. What was unfolding before his very eyes was an inexplainable, angry, and aggressive wife. He was outmatched. He was Clark Kent. The Superman outfit would never work on her.
He is very gentle in spirit and humble. I have never heard him one time ever raise a voice of anger or aggressive contempt toward Linda, ever. In the face of her behaving in the most aggressive, destructive, with intent to harm toward him. And this is a reflection of his character. He held on to his principles at an enormous cost to his, frankly, to his life.
Lee had not spent a lot of time thinking or learning about what relationships are all about. He had no access to clinics or coaching on the subject. Worse, he was incapable of envisioning anything but 100% success. Look at what he had done. How hard could this be?
Lee is not conflict-oriented, and she was at the height of her disorienting anger, accusation, and complete aggression toward Lee, and this is where Lee became bewildered and utterly, completely disoriented. And the only reason why I know this is they stayed in our house for 2 weeks during the 1996 Olympics, and his wife is the only human being that my wife has said would never be allowed in our home again. Her displays of outrageous aggression toward him in particular, and jealous and fits and bursts of pure insanity were traumatizing to him. He is not an aggressive or intentionally pugilistic personality. And she, I don't think I've ever seen a spouse treat another spouse with such abuse.
She was trying to really hurt me, hurt my reputation, hurt me as an individual, physically and mentally and emotionally, even in the community.
John Bardas remembers her behavior and how Lee dealt with it.
We know that she was deeply affected by mental illness, not a little bit, and a lot, because of the level at which that she would act out, which was very, very demonstrative. And Lee was always trying to, as I observed it, he was always trying to mitigate the damage to his kids of her acting out, right? He'd sort of protect the kids and get as calm as he could and try not to respond to her, because she was not just acting out. She was also in every turn and corner. She was attempting to damage and provoke him. She would attack him and provoke him, attack him and provoke him. And that was pretty clear to me that that was probably happening for a long time.
She's always been, you know, kind of aggressive and just kind of made us all really scared of her. And, you know, living with that fear of just, you know, her just lashing out on us, or even, you know, I would have to just pretend, you know, sometimes to just be angry at my dad for no reason, just so she would be happy.
That's Mercedes, Lee's second child.
When I would listen to her sing, I'm just like, well, maybe he is bad, you know, and so I just would just ignore it and stuff. But then I don't know why. She just made us think of him so badly for so many years.
Jordan was Lee's first child.
I just thought it was normal that parents argued and that parents didn't like each other. So her influence and just the way her personality is just made me think that my dad was a bad person. My daughter, like the first week, she was a junior in high school, and I hadn't seen her that much over the previous 5 years. But she came to live with me, and so did Adam. He was 10, Mercedes was 16. She was a junior in high school. And she came home after school one day and said, Dad, these boys keep coming up to me saying, boy, you're Lee Kemp's daughter, and they're all excited. I said, Dad, what? I don't understand that. Why are they doing this? And I said, well, are they wrestlers? She said, well, I think so, but still, why are they doing this? And I said, Mercedes, did your mother tell you about me? Did you ever even, she said, no. Did you ever, like, Google my name or anything? She said, no. I was the devil to my kids. That's the way she presented me to them.
Wrestling to me was almost like a bad thing because it was associated with my dad, and my mom wanted me to be against my dad. Most kids, if you had a dad who was a world champion in a sport, you'd be more involved in it. And I don't think I ever got the fair chance to do it.
I really didn't have any idea how good of a wrestler he was. Like, I remember, you know, when he lived with us, like, all together at home, but there was just always so much negativity, and he never ever talked about wrestling.
Adam was Lee's last child.
My first real memory that I think back to a lot is a poster that my mom had of my dad and me in my brother's room. And it was like him in on a single leg, and a bunch of flags bordered the poster. And believe it or not, I didn't even know that was my dad. It's kind of weird. I didn't know that was him. I just saw like the poster there. And yeah, I mean, I'd look at it a lot, but I didn't know what he was doing. She never explained it to us ever. She never said that he was a 3-time world champion or Olympian. She never talked about wrestling. I honestly had no idea what wrestling was until I came to live with my dad. It's kind of sad to say, but I didn't even know. I was just like some of the population that knows WWE. It's sad to say, but I didn't know that wrestling existed. I didn't know that he was the Olympic coach. I didn't really know any of that. I just knew my mom. She's always been really, really very like mad towards him. So she would paint her own picture of him and like paint it for us. But we didn't really accept that because we just knew that was kind of how she is.
When he was inducted as one of the top, I think it was, they had the all century team from the NCAAs, and he was on it. And it was 10 guys. I mean, it wasn't a lot of people. It was in St. Louis. And it was, I think, either shortly after the Olympics or before, I think after. And it was really a task for him to get her through him to admit to going. She never wanted him to be recognized. Lee had not received his Olympic credentials from 1980 and 96. One of my dear friends took him down to the village to get his credentials, which he had never received as an American Olympian. It was very emotional for him. But she had worked very, very hard for a long period of time to suck the life out of him, because giving him any status in front of the family or his children was something that she wanted to prevent, and she worked hard at it.
Everyone suffers in a problem marriage. Children absorb relationship patterns that's around them like a sponge. They are impressionable and naive, so they end up taking on guilt when it doesn't even have anything to do with them.
When you put kids in that type of situation, whatever they see in front of them or whatever they see every day is what they think is going to be normal.
It was hard growing up just because of, I always felt like I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And, you know, I've always wanted to have a good relationship with my dad.
There's a chemical bond, whatever type of bond there is. There is such a strong bond between children and a mother, regardless of if the mother is sick or not, you know, mentally or whatever. And Linda had that bond. She had such control over children that it just made it very, it just had another layer of stress and another layer of hopelessness. You know, I felt like it was me against the four of them, my three kids and her. There was a wall there, and she kept that wall up, and the kids stood on that other side of the wall.
There is a point when marriage reaches toxic proportions that you have to ask yourself, what is better, being miserable every day for the rest of your life to ensure that your family is intact, or split up? But Lee had only one way of looking at that, too.
I didn't know how to quit. I didn't know how to give up. I felt like it was wrong to quit, you know, even though it was bad. And even though my situation was bad, I just accepted it as similar to someone coming down with an incurable disease or something like cancer. I just felt that, okay, this is my lot in life and I just have to make the best of it. That's just kind of how I looked at it. I didn't really think about trying to get out. Of course, I shouldn't say I didn't think about it. Of course, I wished for a better life. I wanted to be happy. I could leave that situation and get married and probably have a chance at a better marriage and other children with a woman that I loved and cared about. But I never did that because I always wanted my kids to be full, whatever you want to call that, you know, brothers and sisters from the same mother and father. Because I had seen too many examples or too many situations of broken homes or whatever.
Never mentioned his wrestling. She would always say that sport is weird and, you know, she didn't want Adam doing it because of, you know, two guys, you know, like the contact.
Let's take a break with a message from one of wrestling's legends. When we come back, Lee Kemp gets a much-deserved break, which alters the rest of his life.
This is Mark Chiarella, a distinguished member inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in 1999. And you are listening to Etched in Stone, Stories of Wrestling Legends. The stories take you inside the lives of some of the greatest athletes ever with competitors, coaches, teammates, those who knew these athletes best weigh in on their accomplishments with their own unique perspectives. Don't miss a single episode as the National Wrestling Hall of Fame and USA Wrestling bring these stories to life. USA Wrestling provides quality opportunities for its members to achieve their full human and athletic potential and strives to be the world's best sports organization. To learn how you can become a member and download a complimentary storybook of all distinguished members' stories, go to teamusa.org.
Just when it couldn't get any worse, fate intervened. She left him. Many friends advised him to get an attorney and get a divorce, but Kemp does not quit. But there was no plan in his playbook for this. He hung in there 4 more years, but no good deed goes unpunished. She took the kids and left without telling him where they were. Linda was a social worker. She knew how to work the system. To prevent any legal action by Lee, she went to the court and got a restraining order.
She had the kids write letters to the judge, to the courts. And now once the restraining order is in place, she calls me on a regular basis. You know, you want to see your kids? There's a restraining order. Well, you know what? I'm not gonna play around with you. If you want to see your kids, you can come see them. But of course, I would break the restraining order by going to see them. And she did that on purpose.
Lee was about to find just how good a friend he had in John Bartus. But even John's extreme kindness, guidance, and friendship could not contain the oncoming slide.
Sometimes in life, the vibrations that you put out into the universe, they come back right at you. And it seems like the universe was giving back to me the negative vibrations maybe that I was giving off. Sometimes our reality is so negative that it manifests itself in everything that we do, every decision that we do. It seems like it's a bad decision. I don't know why that is, but it seems like everything just keeps going wrong. It's like a domino effect. Things just keep falling in one direction. I felt like that's what was happening in my life. I can't explain it. I really can't understand it.
Lee had gone a long time without talking to his kids. While staying with Bartus, he received a call from his son, Jordan. One of the terms of his restraining order was that he was not to have any contact with Linda. But she knew the way to get to him was through the kids. He returned Jordan's call, but Linda answered.
She picks up the phone. All she said was, "You're in trouble. You're going to jail." I go, "I'm not calling you. This is Jordan's phone." Click.
We only had one phone, and that was my mom's from. So we would ask their mom to like call him and talk to him. I was still pretty young, so he was usually Jordan or Mercedes. And like at the end of their call, I'd get the phone and I'd say like, hey. And but so like Jordan called my dad off mom's phone and he called back like a few minutes later or maybe 10 minutes later. And my mom answered and said, you just violated the restraining order and you're going to jail. And like, that's what happened.
Linda contacted the Atlanta police and again with a sensationally fabricated story. At 3 a.m, a couple of squad cars showed up at Bartus's house with a warrant for Lee's arrest, threatening to break the door down. The police don't show up in an affluent neighborhood in full attack mode without cause. Only Lee wasn't there. But John and his family were. Bartus not only communicated his disapproval of the police's conduct that night, but also hired an attorney and went after Linda for entrapment.
This is my house, my kids, my family, these people. And I felt horrible because he was being so nice to me.
Kemp returned to Minneapolis to face a judge. He had been a bit naive about what he had done. What he had done is violated a court order. He broke the law. The judge was not pleased and imposed an even stricter order, which came with a probation officer. The accumulated trauma from the last 20 years had left Lee a shadow of his original self. John Bartus knew his friend needed a lifeline. He convinced him to get back into wrestling. Wrestling was waiting. In 2005, Bartus was selected as USA Wrestling Greco team leader and connected Lee and USA Wrestling president Rich Bender. Mitch Hull started his college career at Kansas State as a linebacker on the football team. But he had not lost his bug for wrestling, and in 1977, he transferred to the UW. A 1975 state champion from Evansville, Wisconsin, the wrestling room at UW at the time would make any RTC program today envious. John and Ben Peterson, Russ Ellickson, Ron Yeide, Lawrence Soucy, and Pat Christensen.
There's no place in the world, literally in the world, that's better. I'm not exaggerating when I said I went a month without a takedown. It's not exaggeration. I went a month without a takedown.
Before leaving UW, Hull was a two-time All-American and continued to compete internationally, where he won a bronze in the World University Games. After a short stint as Purdue's assistant coach, he joined USA Wrestling, where he spent the next 21 years as national team director. In 2005, Hull would be a part of Kemp's return to wrestling.
Lee had completely lost his identity within wrestling. I mean, Linda wouldn't let him go anywhere near it. That's when he came out of a shell, because that was a step that John took him out of his depression. Because when you're in depression, it's a lack of hope. Well, there's a purpose now.
It came about as a result of pretty much everything in his life being ripped away. He had lost access to his kids. He had moved. He was no longer in Minneapolis area. He was sort of a man without portfolio. My thought was, if he could possibly be reengaged with wrestling at a level that was consistent with his achievements, that, you know, it might create an environment for him to feel better about himself and engaged in something that he liked. And I'm not sure that he didn't just expect to continue to do badly or poorly, but, you know, once he was reintroduced to wrestling, it was pretty much a fish to water, because obviously he is still great and technically sound and knowledgeable and loves it. And it sort of broke him out of a portion of his depression and got him involved with the kids. And he did a great job.
For the first time in 20 years, Lee put his wrestling shoes back on, but not to go and spar with a high school or college team, but in the wrestling room of the World Training Camp, where he ended up going live with fellow 2000 and 2001 NCAA UW NCAA champion Donnie Prislav.
Lee started going live with Donnie. It was 2006. Lee was 50. And he took Donnie down, I believe it was 5 times in a row. And Donnie didn't score on him. Donnie was our world team member. Lee pretty much exclusively mentored and coached Donnie through that world championship, in which Donnie was bronze medalist. He was good enough to go with anybody, and he was 50, and he was nowhere near his prime. With the right environment, could have easily wrestled another cycle after 84. And I would bet money with him being engaged and involved. And don't get me wrong, I have great respect for Dave Schultz, but the rules changed. And then back at the time, right, in 84, they put you down. They never did that before. And that's how Dave scored. And Dave figured it out. He developed that cross ankle turn. But Lee wasn't the same guy in 84. I mean, he didn't even look anywhere near the same. He got on that vegan diet.
Lee Kemp was given up at birth to live the first 5 years of his life in and out of foster care, then the inner city, before being cast into an all-white school. He was the best in the world for 10 years before having his Olympic dream shattered. Then 10 years of a toxic marriage, culminating with 21 days in jail. Yet he steps into the wrestling room at 50 and destroys USA Wrestling's best. In 2006, he was selected to coach the junior world team in Russia. To his surprise, when he returned, his probation officer was waiting. What Lee had not figured out was leaving the country was a violation of his probation. Linda had done some investigative internet surfing and found out that he had left the country. The second trip back in front of the judge would be another new low. Lee had broken the law. But he wouldn't get time to prepare a case or even a court date. It would be justice served up on a time clock. One by one, Lee watched the judge hand down sentences to real criminals.
It's filled with black people, basically. These white judges, there's a white woman judge, and they're seeing all these black men, older black men, that are just given in to that system. And for them, going to jail for 4 months, free food. This judge saw me as one of them. She didn't care who I was. I was just another black face. And I was watching the cases before me. You know, okay, 3 months, boom. 4 months, oh, you've got, boom. And now I'm standing there. She's looking at me. And she already probably had made up her mind that this guy violated restraining order. He's probably no good.
You can be sure there were no other three-time NCAA world wrestling champions with MBAs in front of this judge.
I was just going to tell them my story. She didn't give me a chance to. You violated the restraining order. You broke the law.
He was sentenced to 30 days in jail.
It was horrible, man. It was like the worst thing that you can ever imagine, man. I mean, there were some fights breaking out, and I actually had to kind of mentally get in a place where I had to think to myself, okay, I know I can defend myself.
Nothing went smoothly, you know, a lot of in and out of courts and, you know, having supervised visitation, a lot of unnecessary things. My dad went to jail for literally no reason. It's just a lot of things happened that shouldn't have happened.
Finally, that day came. And I got up in the morning excited that I was going to be leaving prison. Finally, it was over with. I get up in the morning and no call, nothing. Nobody came to get me. Nobody said anything. It got to be about noon. And I wanted to talk to someone, but you just can't go talk to people when you're in jail. So you have to put your name in a little box. I end up getting my one call. I called John Bardis. I don't know what he was doing with his day, but he stopped probably everything that he was doing, called an attorney and got involved. And so now, after I'm off the phone, I'm in the dark again because I don't know what's going on, what's happening. All I know is I'm just sitting there. Finally, someone said to me, well, you know what? We do show that you're not supposed to be here anymore, but we don't have your release papers. So what we're going to do is we're going to schedule you to go before the judge tomorrow. It's probably around 2 or 3 in the afternoon now. And I'm thinking, I got to spend a whole nother day here. This jail right downtown in the city, when they pick murderers up off the street or whatever, that's where I have to go now and wait overnight and then see the judge the next morning. So I get in this like a paddy wagon type of thing with other inmates. And now I'm riding in this paddy wagon down to the county jail. I'm in the orange county jumpsuit and I'm sitting there in this holding cell now. And these holding cells, man, I wasn't, but you could be in there with anybody, like anybody. So I'm in this county jail cell, which is a small cell with 2 bunk beds and barely 2 shoulder width apart. That was one of the hardest times in my life, man. Just like the movies, you know, when it's time to eat, you have this little slit of a door in the door of your cell. As I'm sitting in this cell, just freaking out, basically, I wasn't freaking out like hysterical. I was just weeping. I was just like, I was just sad. All of a sudden, I get this call over the loudspeaker, which I thought I heard my name, and they said something very abruptly like, get your things, you're leaving. So now I put this wrinkled suit back on, you know, that's all the only clothes I had. My cell phone, which was dead because it had been sitting there for 21 days. I remember Greg Clark. He came to visit me a couple times when I was in jail. So I called Greg up and let him know I was out. He came immediately to pick me up, to take me in my car. But we had dinner, and he's a vegetarian like me. So I had all this crappy food for 21 days in jail. Finally, you know, we go to this nice vegetarian restaurant. We sit and eat together. It's probably one of the most enjoyable meals I've ever had, just sitting with him. And took me in my car. Then I go immediately to the airport.
Just one more domino.
I booked a flight, the very next flight out. Took the car back to the dealership. I had someone from the dealership drive me to Minneapolis Airport, and I'm back to Atlanta. And then my car's in a parking ramp there for 21 days. So I had this big bill to pay when I got there. But I remember seeing John for the first time, and he kind of looked at me and kind of said, well, you know, I hope you're ready to listen now. It was a horrible ordeal for just not listening. And I just didn't think things were ever going to go right again.
Kemp was not through dealing with adversity. The 8 years he had spent building up his dealership was about to go down the drain. While dealing with his broken marriage in jail, he elevated an employee to partner.
When I realized that I, you know, that I couldn't be in the dealership environment anymore, you know, I ended up going down that road. I was going with Linda, going to jail. I just, before that, though, I knew that things were bad. So the agreement that we had that he was going to buy me out, he never really honored it. So when I finally realized that was not going to happen, I had no access to money. And then he ended up losing the dealership. The dealership went bankrupt. So I lost everything. And then the courts believed, you know, that I was lying. All car dealers are crooks. And thought he and I were hiding the money, all this kind of stuff.
He finally settled his financial differences with his wife when he was offered and took a salaried position at 24-Hour Fitness in Chicago. He had given up hope of ever having a relationship with his kids. And then...
when I got that call for my kids to come with me, I couldn't foresee that was ever going to happen. Every conversation I had with her was, it ended in some argument. The week before they got there, I didn't have a place to stay. I was sleeping on the couch of or at least in a spare room on an air mattress at someone's house. That's just how broken I was. I didn't know what was happening to me. And I get this call and I'm saying, the sister's saying, well, I'll make sure you get them if you can take care of them. I said, well, sure. And I get off the phone and I'm like, I don't even have a place to live right now.
Lee was not sleeping at night.
So I was just looking around the neighborhood for someone that was going to be, you know, renting their house or a room in their house themselves and not through an apartment complex, because then I wouldn't have to go through a credit check and all that stuff. And all of a sudden, this for rent sign popped up on the lawn of a house. And I called that for the first week. And I only had 1 week left, you know. And it took a week for finally someone to answer the phone.
He got someone's attention, but he was going to dig deep back into his car sales days to close this one.
And it was seemed like an older guy with a real heavy Mexican accent. So anyway, I finally got through to him and talked to him, and I went to see the place, and I was talking to him. And I told him my story, and Linda has Mexican ancestry in her background. Her mother is Mexican. And so anyway, her name is Carmen. And so Linda's parents never really did anything to hurt me or anything. They were always supporting their daughter, like probably, which makes sense. But anyway, I called Carmen up. I said, Carmen, and she knew about me getting my kids. I said, my kids are going to be coming next week and I don't have a place to live yet. I'm at this apartment. I'm at this house, and the owners are Mexican.
He didn't close him the first day.
I explained my situation to them a little bit, and that your grandkids need a place to live, and their father's here, and he's trying to get his life back together. Blah blah blah. So she talked to this guy, in Spanish for a while, and then he gets off the phone with her, and he says, "Okay, I'll let you move in." And I didn't have a security, didn't have first month's rent or security deposit. And he said, Lee, and his broken English and Spanish, says, there's someone that wants this place and they're willing to pay more for this. Cause after I talked to you yesterday, some other people came in and now they want it and they'll pay me more for it.
Lee was seeing his plan explode before his eyes, but his sincerity and plight touched a nerve.
But I'll let you move in with no money, nothing. So I moved in, and then the next few days, there my kids are. 4 days they're standing in O'Hare Airport, and they were all excited. I'm going to go be with Daddy. He's living in the house. And for them, it was awesome because they were sleeping on the floor of an apartment, and it was their life was hell. It was horrible. And I sent them a picture of the house. Well, before I even had the house, I was drove in front of them, and I just took a picture of it, and I emailed it to them. And, of course, they showed it to the mother and the kids. Mercedes told me, yeah, we're all excited, and this is going to be our new house. It was like amazing, actually. So there they came. But now the reality sets in. It's like, what am I going to do when I have to pay this guy this money? I don't have this money. I don't have a job. And I lived there for 7 years.
I remember the first thing that I was excited about was my dad picked us up from the airport and we drive to the house and I was just so excited that I had my own room. I remember that, like, my own bed and my own dresser and home now, like I had like my own stuff instead of just like an empty room.
That allows me to truly say that I've gone through some unexplainable miracles that allow me to be standing here again. I'm still standing. That's all I can say. When people go through hardships, you just have to keep getting back up and try to remain standing. However you can do that. Sometimes that's all you can do.
He was really caring. He told us right from getting, like, I'm not going to like spank you guys. I'm not going to ever like yell at you guys. Or like he said, I just want to like be like the best dad you guys I could be and like always be there for you.
And if I could go back to being younger, spending that time with my dad, mean, I just didn't even know. I mean, there's parents that are dying to have their kids be around.
And that's the thing I want most out of everything and anything in my life is to be able to have my children be able to love each other.
My dad was just so different, just the way he talked to us. He took time, and you could just really tell that he was just so happy that he finally got to see his kids.
A lot of things happened to him that shouldn't have, you know, just because the way I think, you know, women sometimes are able to kind of take advantage of the system when they get custody of the kids. My dad's a good man, you know. He did everything that he could have done in his power. I know he probably has some regrets of things and how he could have handled things, but the way that he turned out has been such a good example to me. You know, he still never gave up, and he's still always been there for us. So I love my dad for that.
He really wanted to take care of her and help her, but she, those underlying things she went through just didn't really allow that. For some reason, they got worse over time.
Looking back, his kids can't help having regrets.
Would have changed everything. It's a little frustrating for me because I really wish it had been that way. Like, I see a lot of potential myself, but I also have a lot of doubt in my ability because I wish I could have started earlier. And I know that some people are now where they start, but just being it for these like 4 years or 5 years now, it's been really cool to like follow my dad's footsteps. I think I would have been really interested in that as a kid. So I think it would have made a huge difference.
One of Kemp's kids did discover who his dad was in time to consider wrestling, but getting him on the mat would be a challenge. But Lee would do what he had to motivate him.
He told me that if I went out for like my junior high team, he'd pay me.
So Adam went out for the team.
It was weird how at first, I was just kind of going through the motions at first. And then it started to like slowly attach itself to like my pride a little bit. I remember wrestling off for like the JV team, loss. I remember feeling like, dang, like I just lost, you know, to be on the JV team. So, and like my dad's a 3-time world champion.
But Adam discovered something that he had inside him that he didn't know was there.
So just felt kind of bad. So at the end of the year, I finally made the JV team as a freshman. The very middle of the year, and then they had like something called freshman sophomore state, and I remember that feeling kind of made me want to go back at it the next year to at least qualify for that.
The bug nibbled at him until his senior year when he finally got bit.
So junior year going into senior year, I trained at Izzy Style. I qualified for Fargo. Competed at Fargo. I didn't place, but I just did a lot of more off-season wrestling. And then the next year, I qualified for state again, and I placed fifth, beating a guy that had like pinned me and just beat me. He beat me twice in my high school career, and I beat him to place fifth.
Fresno State offered him a scholarship. Adam did not disappoint, making the team his freshman year.
I'm learning that I always hit my goal. And I think that part of it is I'm maybe aiming too low. So my goal is to be standing on first and wherever the national is. That's always going to be my goal from now on.
Kemp won't let a job define or confine him. He continues to coach. He's one of the top clinicians in the world, not only in wrestling, but martial arts, and is highly disciplined with his body and nutrition. If there were a Mr. World title for 63-year-olds, he'd at least be in the finals. But most importantly, he is at peace. All three kids are in California. He lives in Sacramento so he can be close to his son, Adam. Jordan graduated from C.S. Fullerton and is talking to Silicon Valley. He talks to his daughter, Mercedes, every day.
Things just sort of fall into place based on God's divine providence is the way I look at it, because things have happened in my life that, I mean, I can say they were miracles, and we hear people talk about miracles, and we'll watch programming, whether it's religious or not, and people will talk about some sort of a miracle that happened in their life, and we sit and watch those things, and until you actually go through one or two or three, in my case, I'm continually going through things that I just can't explain why they happened to me in the way that they did.
His kids didn't know him as they grew up, but they know him now.
He's happy because he's finally in a state where all we, you know, Jordan lives, I live, and Adam. So we're all living here in California. So that is what really makes him happy, you know, that we're kind of like only like a 5-hour drive away rather than across the country. And then he's happy because he's doing what he loves, wrestling, you know, giving back to the community and showing his skills still, you know, which is kind of hard to put into words just because I never thought this is how, you know, our lives would turn out right now.
Very, I'd say very nurturing. He wants to see his children grow and to accomplish their goals. Like, he just always is looking for opportunity to, like, give Mercedes advice, give me advice, give Jordan advice, and to tell them, like, the correct way to maybe go about doing things and use some of his personal experiences and connections to help us. And I just think he's very nurturing. He's always there.
He's very stubborn, but very hardworking. You know, he always talked about perseverance when I was younger, and I think it passed on to me, you know, to finish what you start.
His career as a whole, I call it iconic because just the discipline that I know that he goes about his life every day. It's hard to imagine someone being more disciplined than he is. I mean, with his diet, with his day, with the things he does, it's just the stuff he consumes. It's motivating, and it's just iconic. He's a legend.
I've been under stress my entire life. I can remember at the height of my wrestling career, people would give me all this praise and stuff, and I never knew I was going to be on the team next year because I had Schultz to beat, and if it wasn't Schultz, it would have been someone else. I mean, there always is someone tough to beat, and so I was always like the hunted, I felt like. I felt like there always was a bullseye on my back. I could never relax. I could never let my guard down, And when I was done with wrestling, I was thinking to myself, I just can't wait to be done. I get to be a normal person.
If you take an African-American kid who was given up for adoption at birth from the inner city, and they spend 5 years in foster care, and look at the probabilities around what happens to their lives, I don't even want to guess at what the incarceration rate would be, right? But I'm going to guess it's pretty high. Lee's personal nature and his parents, his adoptive parents, Jesse and Leroy, are tremendous testimony to restoration. He never got completely away from, and who could, from the traumatizing effects of that life, right? I mean, I look at Lee's life more as a victory than a defeat, because that guy could have broken anywhere along the way and failed in a million ways, right? But God blessed him because he gave him a great high school coach, the guy who recommended him to Wisconsin out of Ohio. He ended up with Dwayne Clevin and Russ Hellickson.
Lee Kemp was damaged by the boycott in 1980, more than any other athlete in the Olympics, because he would have been a world champion in 78, world champion in 79, Olympic champion in 1980, and would have retired, no question, at 24 years of age.
he's conquered the most important thing, and that's himself. You know, that's what Jesus said, right? I've never seen Kemp ever in my life, ever misbehave against the principles of Christianity. And he has always, I mean, if anyone I ever knew, I mean, there are lots of people who think they have reasons to, but this is a guy who was given ample opportunities to do that. He never did it. Do you know that he never lambasted the mother? Knew she was mentally ill, and he spoke that truth. He did not go further.
He has learned to relax and appreciate accomplishments few athletes will ever achieve.
Lee Kemp, in my opinion, in his prime, was not beatable by anybody in his weight class anywhere in the world. And I think he proved that, right? I mean, during his run, where he won 3 world titles and received a bronze medal, he won a grand total of, I believe, 4 World Cups, 5 Pan American Championships, 3 world titles, and ended up from his freshman year NCAA championship match forward, he ended up losing a grand total of 2 matches by a grand total of 1 point.
I mean, you know, would he ever miss practice? No. Would he ever be out of shape? No. Would he ever not be prepared mentally for the match or physically? No.
Wrestling was his life. He was absolutely committed to the sport of wrestling. He loved it. He loved competing. There was no stage too big for him. At any time during the time that I was around him as a coach, you couldn't put him in an environment that he couldn't handle in wrestling. He was totally committed to performing at his highest level, and his highest level was always good enough to beat anybody he confronted at the time. He wasn't overwhelmed by any of it. He was truly prepared for that level of performance every day of his life. You could never, ever stop him. You couldn't. It was his life.
Having been around the sport since I was 10 years old and just loving the study of it, Lee Kemp was the best wrestler I ever had met or known. And I still hold that opinion. He had no weaknesses in his game. His work ethic was unbelievable. His genetics were the best you can possibly see in a human being. His conditioning, his quickness, he had no weaknesses.
You didn't find a weakness in him, because his overall persistence to have no weakness was very obvious. He left no stone unturned to make sure that you weren't going to find a vulnerable spot to be able to score on him. And the thing that for me was absolutely staggeringly obvious when you watched Lee compete, when he needed points, he got them. You could get down, you know, people say sometimes he wasn't overly aggressive and he matches were close. But when you got down to the final 15 seconds, he was going to be on the leg and he was going to take you down when time ran out. He had the point. There aren't very many people who could do that. His speed and his power and his technique and his psyche in combination were just plain unstoppable.
You go from your sophomore year in college to 3 world titles, 5 world cups, whatever, 6 or 7 Pan American championships, and your record is that you've lost in total 2 matches by a grand total of 1 point.
Things could have gone so different for Lee Kemp. Given up at birth, but then saved by Leroy and Jesse Kemp at 5 years old, it took him until his sophomore year in high school to realize that he didn't have a move to the basket and he couldn't shoot. Again, he got steered in the right direction, adjusting to being a black boy in an all-white world. He was looking for that something to feel fulfilled and to fit in. If we filmed a scene from the camp he attended in the summer of 1972, it could be a scene from The Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy sees Oz for the first time. Meeting Dan Gable would set Lee on a journey down the yellow brick road. Oh, what a journey. He possessed a secret vision that was so grand that he dared not share it, winning 4 NCAA titles. He had the raw strength and character, but would that be enough? Another disappointment was filled with an opportunity when his dream school did not show up when it counted. But the University of Wisconsin did, and it introduced a technician who would match his physicality and character with the third and final ingredient, creating a path to success. Lee's domination on his feet and tie-ups were designed by Hillickson. Clevin put together a program that provided a competitive supporting cast, year-round freestyle training, and international competition with a focus on winning NCAA titles. When he walked away from UW, he had won 3 NCAA titles, was runner-up as a freshman, and earned his MBA from one of the country's most renowned business schools. He would take all of it down his yellow brick road on a quest to fulfill his dream of winning an Olympic gold medal. Then he discovered there's no Oz, but rather a man behind the curtain. The game is rigged. The yellow brick road begins to have bumps and potholes, and there is not an enchanted forest to guide him. One bad turn sends him off a cliff. There wasn't a honeymoon for Lee. He went directly to a toxic marriage with a mentally ill woman who refused treatment and whose life was defined by torturing him. But 2 values that define Lee were that he never gave up and he is very stubborn. His patience paid off. His former wife, without someone to support her, gave up. Today, Lee has left the past in the past. He has all 3 of his kids back and enjoys the kind of life a champion like him deserves. He has left the stress of winning championships in life in the rearview mirror. He now focuses on his kids, and maybe, just maybe, one of them will be an All-American someday. Etched in stone, that's a legend, Lee Kemp. Etched in Stone is an exclusive production of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame and USA Wrestling. Download your free souvenir book of Legend on the Rocks or any of the Etched in Stone stories produced at the NationalWrestlingHallOfFame.org. The storybook includes the written story and is filled with pictures and videos of their live matches. This will be the first of many storybooks produced about these legends. Start your collection now. And while you are on the National Wrestling Hall of Fame site, take a deeper dive into the profiles of the 179 distinguished members inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame.